From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at how coronavirus is impacting the supply chain for businesses both locally and internationally. Then, a veteran who served 3 tours in Afghanistan talks about why he believes the U.S. military should withdraw troops.
Got friends with 10-plus deployments, and they don't have any rest. You know, we're exhausting this resource of our best people to protect us in a real emergency.
Plus, as preparations are underway for the 2020 DNC in Milwaukee, we look at how hosting the convention could help Democrats win Wisconsin.
It might be enough to tip the balance in favor of the Democrats for hosting their convention in Milwaukee, and less so, but still a real possibility, tipping North Carolina against President Trump because of what happens in the Charlotte media market.
Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Throughout the globe and the U.S., governments and healthcare agencies are working to slow and stop the spread of COVID-19. And it hasn't just impacted people's health. It's also had a huge impact on jobs and the health of our global markets. Manufacturers are struggling to manage the pandemic's growing impact on their supply chains, as factories and plants have shut down or significantly reduced their production, particularly in China. Many companies rely on China as a single-source supplier to secure parts or keep costs low. This pandemic has shown this supply chain's vulnerability. So what can companies do to strategize and get past the coronavirus's impact without heavy losses? To help us understand, Martin Staples joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio. He worked in supply chain operations for Emerson Electric in Racine for 25 years, overseeing international operations. He's now a consultant, and he begins this conversation by explaining the basics of chain supply.
Companies make and sell products. Well, in order to do that, if they're a physical business, they've actually got to buy materials, which is part of the supply chain. So where do they get the materials in order to put them together to sell you, whatever it might be, your iPhone or Harley-Davidson motorcycle, whatever it could be? Parts come from around the world at different locations.
So when it comes to supply chain, is this an integrated part of a business's strategy, cost, you know, risk,
definitely,
all of that?
Yeah, material usually makes up, and it'll vary, but it'll be from 60% to almost 80% depending on the industry. So a significant portion of it, and so they spend a lot of time planning on that. General process is, you know, on an annual basis, we'll kind of look and say, okay, what are we going to sell? They kind of lay out how much of material they're going to need. And then monthly, they're going to set up like a 12-month rolling forecast and say, this is our demand, you know, the whole supply and demand. So if we got that much demand and we've got to sell, we got to buy this much material. So they'll start planning month by month where it is, and they'll update that every month. So generally people are looking 12 months ahead trying to plan because lead times can be pretty long. They're not necessarily that short.
So as the COVID-19 virus continues to impact China, what do basic operations in China look like for American companies? You used to work for 25 years for Emerson Electric here in Racine. So what was your experience there, just to localize it?
Right. So my experience with Emerson, I actually had, at one point before working for InSinkErator, I had factories in China and I had suppliers in China. So I spent a lot of time there. China as a manufacturing location is kind of interesting because the factories are, they range the whole spectrum. You can have highly manual operations with tons of people, you know, and then you can have highly automated ones, you know, which are even more competitive. How can I say this? They're more automated than the some of the factories we have here in the U.S., a lot of capital there. What's interesting is that almost everywhere in China, though, there's a ton of people in the manufacturing process. And for the manufacturers, there's a large migrated population. About 100 million moved from the inner parts of China over to the coastal cities where all the factories are. And so with this coronavirus, that's a bit of an issue for these people to travel around.
So in your experience traveling there with Emerson Electric, was it a mix of a lot of people involved in the manufacturing process and a lot of automated? What was the basic makeup for that?
Yeah, so generally companies will do, and this is almost any company, but you go to a low-cost manufacturer, you basically say, what's the cost of capital versus the cost of labor? So if my wages are low, I can actually use more labor than capital. If I'm getting into higher wages, all of a sudden I have to start investing in more automation and more capital to do that. China has actually been having increased wages, and so people have been investing more and more into the capital side. And this does vary by industry. If you look at electronics, it's highly automated because it's very precise and very detailed. And other some of the low-tech industries, such as machining and all that, some of that can be very manual. I've seen people just doing things on hand lathes with no safety equipment. So it really runs a gamut.
Your current consulting business helps with companies dealing with this problem right now. So everything from electronics to clothing companies. So in your role right now, what are you seeing with the impact of the coronavirus and how you're trying to help these companies either strategize to last or strategize to hopefully not have too much loss?
Right. And it's a tough thing. Right now, there's a lot of unknown out there. So the best example is the one where I'm dealing with the electronics. And the majority of the electronics, or at least electronics components, come out of China. So we were actually caught because the Chinese New Year, which is usually a couple weeks shut down, and then China extended that. So there's a critical component we need that we are unable to get. So pretty much everything was on hold for a month. So it wasn't until they came back from that that we could actually get that on order. So that put a big hole in the whole supply chain. So if you plan out months in advance, you get this ongoing stream of materials coming in. Now you got a hole that's not there, and that's a problem. And it wasn't just that period that China was shut down. They basically shut down the whole economy. But now that they're coming back, even the shipping is the transportation's not there because as one of the things that people did was to stop the commercial flights into and out of China. Well, a good portion of air freight actually goes on commercial flights. So the lighter things like electronics, a lot of that flies on commercial airlines. And now that even though it's made over in China, we can't get it over into the U.S. So it's extended way beyond where we thought it was going to be. So we're still struggling. And we're quoting some additional suppliers here in the U.S. who would be assembling. They need components from China. And their lead time to quote for us is like out of 18 weeks. And that takes me into July. So I have a big hole in my whole supply chain right now we're trying to sort through. So we're looking at alternative suppliers who have different supply chain routes, seeing what we can do to find, you know, a strategy of a short-term fix, which may be a higher cost, and look at a lower-cost long-term solution.
With short-term higher cost, even though the labeling is short-term, there is no quite short turnaround in this business, though, correct?
That's correct. So there are some stocks of components out there in different areas, but now I'd say the strategy that people are doing is trying to buy things and get it into their warehouse as opposed to leaving it in a distributor's warehouse. So it's a bit like hoarding when there's something going on and everyone wants bread.
Or toilet paper or hand sanitizer.
Or masks, whatever it could be. You call your thing. The same thing's going on in the industry. People say, well, it's better to be in my inventory than in my distributor. So if you're willing to pay the price, people are jacking up the price. And so you could pay a premium to get something into your house or into your warehouse for the short term, that'll hold you over until you get to the long term.
And are those strategies pretty much the same, whether it's on a local or national level?
Well, it's interesting. I would say yes. Most companies should be out there right now, and hopefully they've already done this. If not, they need to start doing that, is start to evaluate their supply chain and understand, okay, are my suppliers in China? What's the risk? Is there something in a distributor? Even contact your distributors and say, how much do you have on the shelf? You know, is there some that I can bring in or whatever it might be? And then go to your suppliers, you know, who are here locally and ask, how many parts do they buy from China? So you need to start to evaluate that. And companies are doing that, you know, locally or internationally. You know, a more international one will be reaching out to China. A local one should also be reaching their suppliers and making sure that their supply chain isn't at risk. I think those are the major strategies, you know, trying to do what you can and just keeping in contact with your suppliers is really key because then you're known. As long as you're touching base with them, if it really comes, you know, to a tough situation, the more they know you, the better they're going to serve you. So that's also
helpful.
Does
the same follow for customers? Are companies trying to have open communication and saying, like, hey, you might notice XYZ, this is why?
They are. You're trying to be proactive. You know, no one likes to have surprises, and that's always an issue. So the upfront communication you can do with, you know, your customer and say, we're seeing these longer lead times. Be aware. We're going to do everything we can to serve you, but be aware that this is coming. I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing the stuff in the stock market. People are starting to see this kind of ripple through.
With supply input for companies, there's also the effect of the consumer market, right? So
Correct. People,
there's not as much things to buy. Also, China's market is consumers.
Correct.
They're also having a drastically different
pace
with that.
Yeah. I mean, I think this started out initially with China as a supply chain issue, but it's turned into a demand issue. Definitely in China, where everything's shut down. We talk to people and no one's out in the street over there. You know, they're staying in, they're ordering food at home, et cetera. And we can already see this in places like Italy and even in the U.S. Things have started to be canceled, South by Southwest and some other events. That's going to be a drop in demand. So it's probably going to be, you know, we call it a bullwhip where you got this spikes in demand and then drops in demand. So what you can see is going to happen is there's going to be a drop in demand. So suppliers will start to order less. And then all of a sudden there's going to be a peak in demand. And now the suppliers can't catch up again. And sometimes the supply chain shrinks when there's these kind of drops. I've already heard of some situations where some suppliers are struggling. If they go out of business, when the demand comes back, now it's tight and then it becomes more of a crisis again.
Right. And right now there's the immediate cash flow problems for companies in the short term or long term. We don't know how long this could extend.
That's correct.
So has there been any precedent of the government or even local state government giving breaks or incentives so that the impact isn't felt as deeply in situations like these? Because it's not a matter of failing as a business because your business plan wasn't
resilient.
You know, this is a global impact that no one can anticipate.
Right. I'm not an expert in that area, but I believe that there were steps taken back in 2008, 2009 to add some liquidity in the market to help companies out during that time. And some of the stimulus that they're talking about doing of, you know, cutting payroll taxes and other things can help out for workers and so forth. So those things will be very helpful. But, yeah, a lot of companies, I'm trying to remember, I think that there were some big initiatives taken back in 2008, 2009 with the auto workers specifically because they were concerned that as demand dropped, a lot of the automobile supply chain would be shut down. And so they want to make sure they were there to be available when they came back and they could respond.
Do you recall what Emerson Electric was doing around that time, or was it kind of hit and miss?
I lived through that. It was tough. I started here in 2008 in St. Louis at a company, and then I was over in 2009 in Slovakia running a company. So I had a chance to see both sides of it, and it was a global impact. So we reduced the workforce quite a bit, actually. And I remember in my factory in Slovakia that time, we actually went to the workers and negotiated that everyone took a 10% reduction in wages so we didn't impact the workforce. So, you know, it's time to be creative, you know, because you kind of need to figure out how can you do it because you want to have the workforce there and you also need to have the capacity there. So I would say Emerson, a lot of companies, what they'll do is during a downturn, you want to actually try and improve your process because you want to get stronger. So you try and do any restructuring you can and get yourself in a better situation so when it comes back, you're more efficient.
Do you think this could plunge the global economy into a recession?
Those are the reports I've seen.
Right.
I'm not an economist, but what I've been reading is that it could be. And
or do you see the similar kind of patterns that is only a matter of time until things?
Yeah, it's hard to say. And again, it's my opinion, but I was reading The Economist, and they had a really interesting report. I think it was from the World Health Organization. The World Bank. And they were showing the impact on the GDP globally and by region, depending on how severe the crisis gets, if it's mild or if it's severe. And if it was severe, it was going to have a significant impact on the global economy. I thought it was down like 4% globally for a severe outbreak.
Yeah, because it's hard when people's minds go automatically to that when they see the stock market pause for a day or plummet. But when there's a widespread panic, I imagine, do businesses look at it the same or do they have a known relationship of like, well, this is what is being reported, but we'll deal with things as we feel them or adjust.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone, again, companies tend to do this monthly review of their demand. So they're looking and they're talking to their sales force. They're trying to get feelers as to what's going on. And I would say a lot of companies in the supply chain right now are kind of nervous, you know, and the customers, you know. It's kind of an unknown. How bad will it be? So I don't think a lot of people are making a lot of long-term bets on their purchases for materials. So I think they're going to be a little more hesitant as to what they're going to do. But so they do hear what's going on with the economy and what they hear in the news, but they're also listening to see what their customers are telling them at this point. You know, in the U.S. economy, what is it, 70% is consumer consumption or consumer buying? So any kind of consumer confidence drop as a result of this, or even just, you know, the social distancing that they talk about is going to have a big impact on consumption.
The past trade war between the U.S. and China already had people reevaluating their supply chains. Right. So do you think this just proves that we just need an overall more resilient supply chain? And what do you think that would look like?
So, you know, there's not a one model for a supply chain. We did a lot of analysis trying to figure out what is the best model for a supply chain. And again, this is generalized because it varies by industry. It depends on what you need. But if you have a short lead time to your customer and a lot of changes, you need to have a very localized supply chain. If you can have longer runs, higher volume, you can have a longer distance supply chain. But we found to be the best for, and this is a larger company. You know, Emerson at that time was like $25 billion in sales. And my company was around $700 million or so. We balanced it so we had about 80% from a lower cost source, which could be Mexico or China, and we had at least 20% coming from a local source, which was a higher price but more responsive. And so having that kind of balance gives you the flexibility. So when there's an issue with your longer lead supply chain, which is lower cost, you can respond to the local one. And having multiple sources for larger volume components is very prudent.
So I don't know how to define short term, I suppose.
Yeah.
What do you think are the key things companies should be keeping in mind right now?
So if I was a company, and what I'm telling my clients to do is we need to make sure we're talking to our suppliers, evaluate the risk to our supply chain. You know, do they buy directly from China, or do they know of any risk to their supply chain from China? And in this fact, even Italy at this point. And just see what it is, assess the risk. If you have some long purchase orders, which might be a, what we call a blanket order for 9-month volume, bring in a little more than you normally would, you know, so raise up to 30, 60 days of inventory on those parts. And just keep the relationship with the suppliers. You want to keep in touch so that you're getting first pass when things go bad.
All right. Well, Martin Staples, thank you so much for joining us and helping us break this down a little bit. We'll see what happens.
Thank you, Audrey. It's been a pleasure.
Martin Staples worked in supply chain operations for Emerson Electric in Racine for 25 years. He is currently the president of Staples Consulting, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. You can find more stories about coronavirus and its impact at WUWM.com. We'll take a short break, then we're joined by Sam Rogers, a veteran advocate who believes the U.S. should withdraw from Afghanistan. This is Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. When the U.S. first invaded Afghanistan in 2001, no one imagined the conflict would last nearly two decades. But 19 years later, there are still U.S. troops on the ground. Although the U.S. government is currently withdrawing some troops from the war-torn country, the landmark peace agreement signed late last month by the U.S. and the Taliban is now in question. Intel suggests the Taliban has no intention of sticking to the agreement. For Sam Rogers, this agreement is a step in the right direction, but the obstacles are all too familiar. Since doing three tours in Afghanistan, he's become a vocal opponent of what he considers an endless war. Rogers is now the Coalition's Director for Concerned Veterans for America in Wisconsin. He joins me in studio. Sam, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So you did three tours in Afghanistan.
I did, with the United States Army.
first as an interrogator and then as an intelligence officer.
Yeah.
What were those experiences like?
Well, my first deployment was during the 2009 Afghanistan surge under President Obama. It was in the southern part of the country, you know, where there was serious fighting. It was certainly my most challenging deployment. Our unit, you know, suffered 40 soldiers killed, I think over 350 casualties, amputees. But at the same time, you know, there was, we were fighting in a, you know, the enemy and protecting each other and retaking parts of Afghanistan that had been lost after 2003. And so it was also rewarding in that we could see the difference we were making and all that kind of stuff. And then my second deployment, 2012, 2013, Afghanistan was safer, but there was more, I was at a slightly higher level that, and I guess I saw more and more bureaucratic kind of infighting, you know, between government organizations internally in the military. It seemed like we were kind of spending more time fighting with each other, fighting over projects, stuff like that. And I left the Army after that, went to school here in Milwaukee at UW-Milwaukee. And eventually went back to the Army as a civil servant, as an intelligence officer, and I did a third tour in Afghanistan in 2015, 2016. That really solidified to me kind of this pressing problem that we're essentially making work for ourselves there, and I couldn't really be a part of it anymore. So I kind of, you know, talked to my wife, and I said, yeah, I need a change of careers. But it was hard for me to walk away from, you know, soldiers, sailors, Marines, Coasties, airmen who, you know, were in harm's way because I'm supposed to be that invisible line of defense, right? I'm supposed to be disrupting enemy networks and plans and thwarting attacks and ambushes and things before they happen. And so in 2018, after my one of my proteges, one of my former soldiers was killed in Somalia, I was taking some pre-law courses and really started doing some looking into the 2001 AUMF, which is the Afghanistan invasion document that was passed by Congress after 9/11. It's a very short document that describes why we're going into Afghanistan and what we're doing there. And that was the justification for having troops in Somalia in 2018. That really kind of shook me to my core and got me engaged in what is now this nationally coordinated campaign to end endless wars.
You know, you said something interesting about your third tour in Afghanistan, that you found essentially, I believe the words you use are, the U.S. is making work for ourselves. What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, it goes by a lot of different terms. I guess mission creep is a good one. You know, the things that the American people sent the military to do in Afghanistan in 2001 were all accomplished very quickly. Right, they destroyed the Taliban government, who, you know, were supporting al-Qaeda and refused to turn them over. They killed the vast majority of al-Qaeda fighters and commanders and stuff like that. And then we just stayed there. And the longer we stayed there, the more complicated those problems that existed well before we were there became. And so, and I think in that vacuum that's devoid of civilian leadership, right, civilian executive leadership, government organizations, government agencies, the military, they just find things to do. You know, the Congress never sent the military to Afghanistan to nation build, right? They didn't send us there to build shopping malls, but those are things we tried to do. And there's been lots of honorable attempts at good work there, but it's essentially make work, and it's things that the American people never really got a say in, and so these things have just been happening over and over and over again. I mean, it consumes a lot of resources, right? Spent over $1 trillion in Afghanistan alone. Consumes our most precious resource, which is people. 3,000 people have been killed there, in addition to, I think, over 1 million life-changing disabilities over the course of the Afghan war to service members. We've engaged essentially nonstop with our special operations forces and, you know, aggressively hunting the, you know, the worst bad guys there. But those guys and gals, part of that community, I mean, they do this stuff nonstop, back to back to back. I've got friends with 10-plus deployments, and they don't have any rest. There's broken families. You know, we're exhausting this resource of our best people to protect us in a real emergency, right? In a real conflict that could arise. We're exhausting that resource. And we're at the point now where what should have been, what was designed to be, what was described as a punitive expedition, right, to go there and punish the Taliban and to take out Al-Qaeda, has turned into this thing where we're killing the grandkids of the people who started this. And it's unsustainable. But no one has stepped up in a meaningful way to end this. And so that's what we're trying to support. We're trying to bring people together, to stand together, to set aside hyperpartisanship for, if nothing else, just this issue, to engage the Congress to repeal that 2001 AUMF, which by both parties and both presidents has been reinterpreted over and over again to include invasions of like 40 different countries. And if we're going to send people in harm's way, there just needs to be a rigorous public debate in the Congress about it so that the American people can say, I don't think that's in our national interest. I don't want to see kids from my school, from my church, from my soccer team. I don't want to see them put at risk for this.
So the U.S. recently signed a landmark agreement with the Taliban. What did you think of that news?
It's a good step. It's great that the president, who ran on ending the Afghanistan war, is trying to take forward movement in this issue. But like I said, I have personally seen previous attempts, you know, under President Obama, whether it's reintegration into the government, whether it's ceasefires or peace deals. I've seen a lot of these things fall apart. And so it's not a replacement for withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. But it's a good signal, and I think it shows people that this is an area that they should be coming together on. I mean, this is probably the thing that the president and congressional Democrats agree on. We want congressional accountability. Less than 20% of the people in Congress who voted for the 2001 AUMF are still there, right? We want Congress to vote on these things so they can be held accountable to them. We want future AUMFs, authorizations for use of military force, to be extremely specific so that these things can't happen. I mean, the whole reason the War Powers Act was passed was to avoid this exact situation, and now we've been there twice as long as the Soviet Union was. And so we're not approaching this from an explicitly, you know, anti-war or anti-military or any of that perspective. We just want a future where the military, use of the military, is not the first step in engaging in other people's problem-solving process, right? It should be the last resort. And I think historically that has served our country extremely well. From World War I to World War II, you know, we didn't get engaged until it was absolutely the last possible choice. And because of that, we came out of those conflicts in a much better place than really the rest of the entire world. I think we need to recalibrate how we look at using our military to engage around the world.
Well, it feels like just from an outside perspective, there's been some level of degradation in that process since we entered the conflict in Korea, since we went to Vietnam, and then this kind of unfolding of the process as we've moved further into more recent decades.
Right. And we are the 800-pound, trillion-dollar gorilla in the room. You know, people talk about, like, well, how is Afghanistan going to adjust? Well, nobody knows what normalcy even looks like for them right now, because everything that they do is built around us sitting there. And, you know, it's not the 1900s. We've got extremely high-quality telecommunication capabilities. We can engage diplomatically around the world without having to send the military first. We can share our vision for a better world through trade and educational exchange and diplomacy and all of these other tools that are constructive and collaborative rather than deconstructive and destructive. And I think that by focusing on using and exhausting those tools first, we'll be in a better place going forward in general.
So we're hearing now there's a persuasive evidence that the Taliban has no intention of abiding by the rules of this most recent agreement. Do you see a way of the U.S. exiting Afghanistan without working with the Taliban?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I think that this was an important attempt for this administration to seek, right, the most constructive diplomatic solution they could to support a withdrawal. But again, it doesn't change the fact that a withdrawal is what we need. Anecdotally, over three tours, I saw consistently the longer we spent there and the more work we did to try to pump up the Afghan government in our own image, regardless of if we ever considered that was even sustainable for them, the more the Taliban itself, right, became fractured, became tribalistic. You know, they have their own infighting, right, because it's constantly shifting from a political organization to a military organization to an insurgent organization, and there are various wings and factions. I mean, it's the definition of a quagmire, right? It's the longer we stand there in the middle of this, the more complicated it becomes and the deeper we get stuck. If we use a measure of, well, things are a mess here, and what if there's terrorism that comes out of here? Well, I mean, under that logic, I mean, the U.S. military should be sitting in, you know, 100 different developing nations who are unstable and could sustain, some terrorist organization might use them as a training camp. And that's just, it's just silly. I mean, I'm not surprised because, again, I've seen those previous attempts at peace cause fractures, both in the government, cause fractures in these insurgent organizations, right? The Islamic State was imported, co-opted various factions of Taliban. Every country around Afghanistan has its own hooks into different insurgent groups, different Taliban leadership, which kind of speaks to the point of, like, these countries that are surrounding Afghanistan are investing time and energy into working with both the Afghan government and Taliban on their borders, right? Those are people who see Afghanistan's security is in their legitimate national interest. So why would we try to create something there that could only be sustained while we sit there and point a gun at it? When there are, you know, half a dozen countries there, you know, with substantial resources who actually will take benefit from Afghanistan becoming stabilized.
As you say, we have our hooks in, the U.S. government has their hooks in so many different pockets now in Afghanistan. Is there an ideal scenario where they can get out?
Yeah, I mean, I think you put trucks on boats and you put people on planes. And, you know, obviously we make ourselves available for diplomacy, for, you know, mediation of future disputes. You know, we try to share our educational system to future leaders of that country because, you know, there's been inconsistent school, right, access since 2001. So you've got, you know, just generations of people who have lost that ability to grow outside of, you know, people who have taken advantage of the U.S. presence to enrich themselves, who have money to send their kids to international schools and things like that while other people just try to scrape by and feed themselves. And we need a reset. And then, who knows, maybe we need engagement with Afghanistan in the future. But without this hard reset, without bringing folks back and saying, okay, if we want to do something with the military there, we need to talk about it publicly and rigorously, and we need a vote so that we can hold people accountable who make a bad decision.
Yeah.
It means, you know, I think 60% of military veterans and families, right, all agree that we have to get out of there. The vast majority of the public is aligned on this issue, particularly in critical states like Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania. I mean, that's where we've been focusing this campaign because the majority of people there, I mean, politically, you know, on across the spectrum from Bernie to Ted Cruz folks can all come together and say, well, let's get our people out of there.
Well, Sam Rogers, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Sam Rogers is a veteran who spent three tours in Afghanistan, and he's currently the Coalition's Director for Concerned Veterans for America in Wisconsin. After the break, a researcher talks about how hosting the DNC in Milwaukee could sway voters here and throughout the state. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. The Democratic presidential nomination may still be up in the air, but preparations for the party's 2020 nominating convention are very much underway here in Milwaukee. Thousands of Democratic Party officials will gather in July to decide who will face off against President Donald Trump in November. Milwaukee was chosen to host the DNC over three other finalist cities 2 years ago. Now that the first votes have been cast in the nominating process, we're going to re-examine some of the reasons why Milwaukee might have been chosen to host the convention. Christopher Mann co-authored the paper Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact of National Party Convention Location, which appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida, who starts by asking why Milwaukee is a logical choice for the 2020 DNC.
Milwaukee does make sense. Wisconsin is an important state, and the research that my colleagues and I did found that when the DNC hosts their convention, in that media market, we would expect a positive effect for the DNC, as long as that media market, in general terms, leans towards the Democrats, and the Milwaukee media market certainly does that. So while there might be other sites that you could argue might also be good choices, Milwaukee is certainly a very sensible choice from a tactical point of view, if the Democrats want to cash in on this historical pattern. Of course, historical pattern's no guarantee, but probably the logic behind the choice of Milwaukee.
Sure. But, I mean, there's a lot of cities that skew Democratic, but, you know, people were somewhat surprised. I mean, I wouldn't say entirely surprised, but somewhat surprised that Wisconsin turned red in 2016 or went so kind of overwhelmingly red. So even though Milwaukee and the media market that makes up this, you know, southeast corner of Wisconsin is certainly, you know, pretty Democratic, it does it have an effect on how things go statewide?
One of the important things about our research is that we're looking at the media market and not the whole state. So earlier research had looked at the state and found little, if any, evidence that hosting a convention was moving statewide numbers. But most conventions are held in big cities and big states, and so they're, you know, a local effect wouldn't necessarily be seen statewide. And what we see is an effect that will be on the order of a couple of percentage points from Milwaukee in the Milwaukee media market. That will be even less when it's sort of spread across the statewide totals, all the places in Wisconsin that are not part of the Milwaukee media market. It's an opportunity to maybe take advantage and get this boost in a state that is close, has been close in presidential elections and close in lots of other elections. And, you know, every advantage is something that the parties seek. And so it makes sense from that point of view.
Sure. And in that regard, the size of the media market, because you're studying media markets, makes sense here. I mean, I think of the 2016 DNC, which happened in Philadelphia, and Pennsylvania has a few different media markets that are heavily Democratic, but here in Wisconsin, there's pretty much just this really big one around Milwaukee, another one kind of by Madison, but they're kind of close by. So it seems like the balance is there, whereas in other states, the Democratic representation is a little bit more of a patchwork.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the Democrats picked Philadelphia. It's the largest media market in Pennsylvania for 2016. They picked Milwaukee, which is the largest media market, as well as the most Democratic-friendly media market in terms of past voting history. And when you compare Milwaukee to some other cities, the media market as a share of Wisconsin is bigger than we see in other states, right? Philadelphia, while it's the largest, is not as disproportionately large because you have Pittsburgh and a variety of other sort of small and medium-sized markets in Pennsylvania. And you could go through a number of other swing states, right? Your neighbors across Lake Michigan and to the north in the UP, right? Michigan has many more media markets. It's harder to have as big a share as you would potentially capitalize this benefit in Wisconsin by coming to Milwaukee.
Sure, and they're also farther apart there, whereas here it's kind of concentrated.
Yes.
So I'm also curious, I mean, you researched the effect that Democratic conventions have and Republican conventions, and for some reason, the Republican conventions don't have the same effect as the Democratic conventions. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, they're not wildly different effects. What we see is primarily an effect on persuasion, and we see both a positive effect in places that lean towards the party hosting the convention and a backlash effect in areas that already lean against the convention. What's really striking about the Democrats is this is a much steeper difference. The Democrats get bigger benefits where they get benefits, and they get bigger backlash where they get backlash. But what this adds up to, when you think about cities, is that most city centers are very strongly Democratic, and the suburbs tend to move into swing areas, and the large proportion of the big urban area media markets are leaning Democratic. That's part of why Democrats get a big boost. What we don't know is why this sort of, it's a much steeper line, if you will, where Democrats get a stronger benefit and a stronger backlash than the Republicans do. That may be the nature of the party. It may be way in which nominees resonate or something about the way the parties present themselves at the convention. We've certainly been curious about that and thought about it a little bit, but we didn't identify anything that we could confidently say was a pattern that defines why the Democratic convention has this stronger local effect than the Republican convention.
Sure. And when you say that there's an inverse effect for the party voting against the one that is hosting the convention with regards to Wisconsin, I mean, following your theory, would you then say that we can predict, in some senses, a smaller Republican voter turnout in Wisconsin come November?
So we tried to separate the phenomenon of turnout, that is mobilizing people who might not otherwise vote, versus persuading people who were deciding between the two parties. And so what we would expect to see here is that in the red counties within the Milwaukee media market, they'll be a little bit redder. The blue counties will be a little bit bluer. And the net effect of that, because Milwaukee is so much larger, when you add this up and cumulatively across the media market of Milwaukee as the host city, that should advantage the Democrats because they get a boost of several percentage points in those, from those Democrats in the area. The trade-off is they lose, some more people in other areas that might be leaning Republican, shifting towards Republican. But the net is a blue boost when you add up everything in the entire media market.
Sure. So it's a matter of density and the kind of rule of thumb that more dense areas, urban areas, tend to skew more Democratic.
Yeah. When you add things up, that is why it comes out to be a net benefit to the Democrats. In Milwaukee, you're obviously much more interested in the Democratic convention. But if you were hosting the Republican convention, right, it would almost be dangerous. The effects are weaker for that Republican convention, but there would be more support from Republican-leaning areas for Republicans, but there would also be more votes for Democrats. And because there are so many more Democrats, hosting the Republican convention is actually, according to the historical pattern, to the Democrats' advantage. If I were having a conversation with your colleagues down in Charlotte, North Carolina, we would be talking about the risk to the Republicans of increasing the Democratic vote share in Charlotte. That is a larger cumulative increase than any benefit they get from increasing Republicans in the suburban and rural areas around Charlotte that are part of the Charlotte media market.
Yeah, and that's really fascinating because, I mean, conventions are huge events. I mean, here in Milwaukee, it's not an exception. I mean, conventions for a long time have been held in sports stadiums, convention centers. You need tons of hotels. You need tons of infrastructure. And places that have this kind of infrastructure tend to be blue.
they tend to be blue in those big cities. And you know, one of the mechanisms that my colleagues and I who did this research point to is exactly all this attention, the local media attention, the word of mouth, the way it changes the sort of civic excitement about what's going on to host a big convention like this. That's different than holding a trade show because there's the national media attention and the spotlight on Milwaukee, where Milwaukee wants to show off. It's a huge civic opportunity to be in the spotlight like this, where all the major news networks will be there and they'll be covering it, showing the beautiful lakefront in Milwaukee and all the other great things that are going on as part of their coverage. So it's a tremendous opportunity. What my colleagues and I have said is that if you are the Republicans because of this risk, they're almost better off holding their convention in a state that's either safely red or safely blue, where it's not likely to tip the balance statewide for the Electoral College. States like Wisconsin or North Carolina, where they're hosting the Republicans are hosting their convention, right? There's a risk in doing it there. Whereas if you did it in a state that wasn't sort of in play, that local effect might not be enough. We're not talking about huge effect, but in a state as close as Wisconsin or a state as close as North Carolina, it might be enough to tip the balance in favor of the Democrats for hosting their convention in Milwaukee, and less so, but still a real possibility, tipping North Carolina against President Trump because of what happens in the Charlotte media market.
Hmm. And the kind of diversity of it. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WWM 89.7 FM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Heidan. We're talking with Christopher Mann. He co-wrote the paper, Where Do Campaigns Matter? The Impact on National Party Convention Location, which appeared in the Journal of Politics in 2014. We're talking a little bit about how conventions affect the local voting dynamics. And I'm curious, do you think or do you know that the party leadership, whether it be the Democrats, the Republicans, or any of the other parties, behind closed doors, do they make the kinds of considerations that we're talking about? I mean, how actively do they consider where to place their conventions?
Before we did this research, they certainly considered it in general terms. We looked at what they had said publicly and looked at, historical documents about the presidential nomination process and debates about where to put the convention. It's pretty clear that people were thinking about this as an opportunity to highlight and impact those states and thinking about it. Since we wrote this article, my colleagues and I have had conversations with various party officials that suggest that they were aware of it going into 2016. I don't want to claim too much of an impact, but I think the conversation continues that they can have an impact, that this does matter to each of the parties and their prospects for the presidential nominees.
Right. And I mean, all of the think pieces that came out of 2016, all of the kind of post-mortem analysis that came out seemed to have pointed out to dropping the ball on Michigan and Wisconsin in particular.
Yeah, it's unsurprising to see Wisconsin, right? For the Democrats, there's a lot of talk about the path back through the industrial Midwest. And Wisconsin is right at the front of that list. So it's unsurprising that was the region that Democrats wanted to go to make their case to the voters, right? There's a lot of symbolism about being there beyond that local effect. We point out in our research, that there's a longstanding pattern that the conventions provide a boost to each of the nominees as they occur, and that's as people tune in and what they see. But I'm sure we can expect the Democrats to highlight a lot of the kinds of themes that are important to voters in the Midwest, because in order to assemble an electoral college coalition, the backdrop of being in Milwaukee and what it means to be a major Midwestern city is going to be part of what they want to convey, not just to local voters, but to voters throughout the Midwest and throughout the country.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that Houston was a finalist to host the 2020 DNC, and a lot there seems to be this divide also among the Democratic Party as to whether or not you focus on the Midwest or do you focus on Latino and Black communities in the South, flipping Texas, for example. And it seems to be they've fallen on the kind of the forgotten man of the Midwest with this convention decision.
Yeah, and I think there was also some discussion of the fact that hosting the convention in Texas right? If there is a bump from hosting the convention there that's felt at the local and state level, Texas is a big reach. You know, if it had been somewhere else in the Southwest, in Colorado, which is a very competitive state, or Arizona, which the Democrats are trying to make competitive, right? Frankly, those cities might have been stronger contenders against Milwaukee with the argument of the path to the White House runs through an electoral college strategy built around the Southwest as opposed to the Midwest. But right, for reasons that I don't claim any special insight into, but the case for the Midwest seems to have won out in that debate about where to host the convention, and thus it's in your fair city.
Well, it's really fascinating, your research, and I want to ask one last question. You know, given the fact that looking forward at elections, all we have to go on is historical data. So in your paper, you reference Florida. Florida in 2000. Everybody knows what happens in Florida in 2000. Pretty much decided the election that year. Do you think that changing where the convention location could have been that year could have determined the, you know, path of the last 20 years with regards to who's president?
You know, Florida is certainly a case that we pointed to where the election is close enough that one party or the other hosting their convention in Florida, the effects that we would expect from any of several major cities in Florida would be enough to tilt the balance. The problem with that claim is that, you know, just about anything could have tilted the balance in Florida. but, you know, it does give you the sense, and it's not out of the realm of possibility to project a state like Wisconsin being, you know, maybe not 500 votes, but a few thousand votes where the net benefit of, say, you know, 7, 8, maybe 10,000 votes to the Democrats' advantage from hosting the convention in Milwaukee might be enough to make a difference in a razor-thin outcome. You have certainly seen outcomes that have been, right, approaching that level of closeness at the statewide level in Wisconsin. So it makes sense for the Democrats to go someplace where this might be enough to tip the balance and where they want every single vote because they expect the state to be razor-thin.
So these decisions are made in part on historical precedent and statistics and in part alchemy.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is the art and the science, always.
Fascinating. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Christopher Mann is a political scientist at Skidmore College. He spoke with Lake Effect's Julian Haida, and that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Stay tuned now for All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.